This episode is sponsored in part by Swim. Okay, here's a depressing stat. 70% of shoppers who want your products never actually buy them. They browse, they consider, then they forget. That's revenue walking out the door. Swim Wishlist Plus turns browsers into buyers. Customers save products they want, get notified when prices drop or items restock. You can also engage them in personalized fashion through your marketing or sales outreach. It's like having a personal shopper reminding them to come back and buy from you instead of your competitors. And 45,000 stores already use it, and it only takes 5 minutes to install. You can try it free today for 14 days. Go to getswim.com/Kurt. That's swimwithay.com/Kurt. Turn those maybe laters into sales today. Getswim.com. So I would say most entrepreneurs would be thrilled if they hit seven figures in their first year. Certainly, I would be thrilled with it. But you know, of course, with that comes a lot of stress. And on the show, we also don't talk a ton about drop shipping. You know, a lot of original products, private label businesses. And so we have someone who has done all of these things and then, well, in theory, maybe failed at it. Oh, I don't like it. That's a strong word. I mean, they did get quite the payout. Well, we have Jaden Clark, who started a successful dropshipping business, scaled it to 1.5 million British pounds first year. Oh my gosh. Then sold it for 500,000 pounds, which he feels is low. And there's reasons. And the reasons are, well, it sounds like he burned out. I mean, that's tough. But that could be the reality. And so I want to talk through that experience with him. Jaden Clark, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks very much for having me. I'm excited.
You had a dropshipping business on Shopify. What year was this?
I started that in 2022.
2022. All right. So still in the bad times, still pandemic. What'd you sell?
So we sold, I suppose, high-end outdoor living, garden supplies, that sort of thing. So our customer avatar, if you like, was someone who loves having friends, family, etc., over in their garden, backyard, whatever you want to call it. And they want to have all the toys that can create a place that people want to be, a place they're proud of. They might have a little bit of an ego, maybe. They might have a bit of a desire for the next door neighbors to think, oh, wow, that's pretty cool what they've got out there. They might want to invite their best friend or their, you know, brother-in-law, whatever it might be, sister-in-law, etc., over and have them be a bit envious. That's who we served.
So what sounds like more expensive items, less rakes and more, I don't know, fire tables?
Exactly right. Yeah, so our average order value was probably close to about 5,000 British pounds when the business was sold. It wasn't uncommon for us to do orders in the sort of mid-teens, early 20s, if that was like bundles of things put together. So that was very much by design. The sort of model I followed, I suppose, and the course for inverted commas success that had been charted before, talked a lot about some of the problems with dropshipping could be solved by working with, you know, domestic kind of high-end proper manufacturers that allowed you to sort of run an inverted commas. And I don't want to throw shade on any business model, but I think traditional dropshipping, we all think about, you know, generally from China, generally right, without sort of a relationship with the manufacturer.
There's a lot of baggage with the word dropshipping.
Yeah. Yeah. Whereas this was, you know, we had really deep relationships with some of our best manufacturers and suppliers, and they were, you know, proper brands that we could be proud to sell. And we didn't have to wince every time something got fulfilled, fearing that it was going to turn up, you know, wrecked or break after a matter of weeks, and there would be no sort of post-purchase support and that sort of thing. So that was a big part of it.
And at this time, this was a side hustle when it started. You had a corporate gig, right?
Indeed, yeah. It was never planned to be a side hustle in terms of the ultimate goal, but certainly it had to be done. I'm actually a pretty risk-averse person. And the idea of burning the boats and going all in was unthinkable for me. And even though I'm still pretty young, I only turned 30 yesterday, actually. I still had, you know, I had a wife, a house, dog, mortgage, you know, responsibilities. I'd been lucky to have a decent corporate career from the time I graduated. So the idea of just kind of risking it all and going kind of all in was unthinkable to me. So it was only going to work if I could kind of get us to a place where we could confidently live on the business proceeds by the, you know, to a place while we were still earning our income in the meantime.
So young guy, pandemic still going on. We got responsibilities and start this dropshipping business. Why garden supplies?
Honestly, just I'm not a particularly, I suppose, emotional thinker, or I wouldn't even say I'm particularly a big kind of blue sky thinker. I wanted to go where the data led me. So I had essentially decided that once I learned a bit about high-ticket dropshipping and thought that was where I wanted to go, because I felt that it worked as a side hustle in terms of, you know, fewer transactions because higher order values. And I knew I therefore wanted to be even at the higher ticket end of that. My sort of ballpark in my mind was that I wanted to be able to do 100K in revenue from roughly 30 transactions, because that's what felt in my mind. I felt that 100K in revenue would be roughly the threshold by which I would feel, and by that I mean 100K monthly revenue. About that point, I would start to feel confident that I had a business that could sustain me and my family. And I wanted to be able to get to that point while still working a full-time job, and 30 customers to give a good experience to felt like a reasonable amount. So that kind of gave me my rough average order value formula, right? I knew reasonably where that needed to be. And then beyond that, it was trying to find the right balance between an industry that was branded enough that there was some equity in some of the manufacturers that would allow me to generate some reasonable sales and traffic from some paid advertising to begin with before the business had any sort of brand of its own or name of its own or organic traffic, but also that wasn't so saturated and competitive that the brand still needed to use retailers and sort of specialists in that sort of marketing and conversion to be able to go to consumer. And that was a nice, of all I looked at, you know, probably 20 or 30 different product sets. And garden supplies, I think, was on a bit of a journey whereby it was quite heavily dominated by physical premises before COVID. Suddenly people had to adapt to wanting to be outdoors in COVID, but not being able to physically go and look at these products in person. So suddenly the e-commerce side of the market was evolving, and it was a nice balance between kind of well-known brands that were reputable that you could work with, but that weren't quite yet so D2C that the value that could be added by a retailer had been diminished too far. So that's why it ticked a number of boxes, and that's why I dived in.
Certainly, if you're in anything that was like outdoor or even tangentially related to outdoor during that time, it really, really did pretty well. You know, e-bikes and bikes in general come to mind as similar categories for similar reasons. Did you ever quit your job to pursue this full time, or did this stay a side hustle, or were you just like, look, I'm doing both?
No, doing both was pretty unthinkable at the time. So yeah, after just shy of a year, I was able to quit my job and go full time. I think that was probably a bit late in hindsight. But as I said, I'm a risk averse person, so I probably felt the need to see a pretty significant number within the context of my own life in the bank before I felt comfortable. My biggest fear by far was letting people down, you know, having to let my wife down, and also, to be perfectly honest, the embarrassment of having to go back to work. I actually,
of course,
told next to no one for the first year of this business, which is kind of crazy because I was probably working about 40 or 50 hours on it. So it's a, you know, you kind of withdraw from social plans, you are quite stressed, and you know, you can't, of course you can, but I didn't feel like I could tell people about what was behind that because of this. I didn't want to add any extra pressure. I was already heaping enough on myself. You know, you kind of have some success and then you fear that if you share it and then it starts to drop off a little bit or times start to get harder, then you've also got the stress of that plus the embarrassment. So once I had about a year to 18 months worth of income in the bank, and that's a good thing about the dropshipping model, right, is you fulfill orders that have already happened, so you don't buy inventory, you don't necessarily therefore have to use retained profits for larger inventory orders to fund growth. So it's a pretty cash flow positive business. So that meant that a good chunk of our profits were sat in the business bank account retained. And by the time that got to a place where I obviously wasn't really taking money out of the business because my full-time job was sustaining me, by the time that got to a place where I had that sort of year to 18 month runway, then I felt comfortable to take the plunge. But funnily enough, even then, I was chatting to my father-in-law about it, who was one of the people that me and my wife told. And he was saying to me, he was like, you're crazy. He was like, you probably should have done this 6 months ago. He was like, what do we need to do to make this happen? And he actually very kindly, he's retired now, transferred me £10,000 as an investment in inverted commas. And he said, you will almost certainly not need this. But for whatever reason, you seem to need the comfort and the permission of some of the money in the bank. So I'm going to put it there until the number's large enough that you start dedicating more hours to this, because the return on investment of what you've done so far is so clear. I think you're a bit mad not to be going all in on this.
That's really, really kind and clever of him to do that, you know, recognizing, hey, what you needed was external validation to keep going, how it sounds to me.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's fair. And funnily enough, that money sat in the business bank account for almost a year. And then he said to me, right, now you're being irresponsible with my capital. So now we've used this for getting you out your own way. He was like, now it's time to work out how you make sure that this is at least, you know, giving you a return greater than probably the 6 or 7% interest that it should at least be earning you. So then we started looking at some inventory and that sort of thing. So he was very good at nudging me out of my own way when I was probably limited by my own beliefs.
The limiting beliefs is tough because they're your beliefs. It's often really tough to recognize them, especially when, you know, you're unwilling to get out of your own routine. The times I've recognized my own limiting beliefs have been when I broke my routine, either, you know, just going on vacation. So I had like the third party or the external perspective, you know, looking outside in by taking a break from it, or just, you know, conferences have tended to be the thing that help. So this store, geez, did we ever mention the name of this drive? What was the name of the store?
Yeah, not my finest moment. We called it Woodlark Garden Luxury. I think I mentioned earlier, I'm not very...
What's wrong with that?
I think it's so long. I actually can't remember a customer getting the name right. I remember everyone who got it wrong, and there was loads of them. I think it was hard to remember and really wordy. In fact, spoiler alert slightly, but the people who bought it actually made a jibe at me once, being like, couldn't you have called it something even longer? Maybe supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.co.uk or something. They were like, this is such an unnecessarily long name. So difficult for everyone.
It's so hard to do businesses.
It is.
Yeah. It is. No, I don't begrudge you that.
And I just wanted to get in, you know, I was like, I just want the name out the way, because that's just one more thing on the checklist of, I was desperate to, in inverted commas, like get in the arena, get some skin in the game. So I just breezed right through that. I was like, that seems good enough.
Hitting seven figures in the first year, like really quite extraordinary, quite unusual, not something most people are going to be able to repeat. And a lot of factors went into that. What, as far as like driving awareness that early in the game is really tough. What do you think the acquisition channels, you know, what worked? What were some of the factors that helped drive this quick success?
Yeah, definitely. I think a few things. I think the first thing that was ideal was I was following, I suppose, kind of a charted path and a roadmap, which I think is actually when I'm best. I think I'm pretty good at executing. I'm quite good at taking in knowledge and understanding. You know, I'm quite good at just being quite militant on then just executing that once I've got the plan in front of me. So Ben Kneggendorf is someone who sort of has a course on this sort of thing, helps people. Certainly excellent at that sort of 0 to 1 stage of the business. And I kind of had access to that. I bought into it very heavily. And I think I was able to quite quick. I always have quite an obsessive personality. So once I started seeing that I had this growth trajectory I could go on in terms of learning the strategies and the levers, and then I could get the feedback from implementing them and seeing business growth, that became quite addictive. And I was able to work hard on that. So in principle, I think the bar success was, I think in other businesses, sometimes like a huge product market fit or something quite radical can cause that rapid success. In this case, I think it was just a case of a fairly simple business model with a pretty clear and well-charted roadmap and set of strategies that I was just able to just go ahead and implement. And I've seen...
Was Ben Kneggendorf the source for that?
Ben Kneggendorf. Yeah, in fact, I actually heard him on this very podcast, which
I was
going
to say,
sort of,
I just had to Google my own show He was on the show January 18th, 2022. And the title of that episode is Ben's High Ticket Dropshipping Approach. I think his 3D printers. Yeah, he sold 3D printers. So again, it was like, you're right. It's high ticket item, you know, that's got, in his case, it was like it had a more technical approach to it. And he was able to get, you know, develop relationships with the suppliers for those 3D printers at that time. You know, today it's different. But yeah, you're right. It is. That's his approach. And oh my gosh, I'm thrilled to hear it worked.
Well, and it was nice for me because it was a bit of like an unleashed moment, because I was listening to the podcast in general. And obviously, you have some incredible founders on here. But
thank you.
My propensity for risk was standing in the way, I suppose. And so sometimes the idea, you know, I'd hear people who are, you know, had placed a lot of geometry orders or had, you know, kind of gone take a bit more of a leap of faith and it'd be, you know, been well rewarded for it. But I was kind of thinking, even for me at the time, the idea of placing like a £5,000 inventory order and then not being able to sell these things felt like I'd be letting my wife and my family down. So the idea of, with Ben's model, essentially, I knew I just needed to work hard, learn the strategies. And my point in the value chain was do good marketing, do good conversion rate optimization, do good customer service. I was like, okay, that feels like I can just work hard and try and learn that. And the only thing I have to give up is my time and my effort and my dedication. And if it wasn't to work, I'll have learned some new skills and hopefully won't have let anyone down. And so that was like, right, that is what I'm going to do. I'm just going to go for it. And I was driving when I was listening to the podcast, and I can still now remember where I was when there must have been some sort of penny drop moment when Ben on your show was describing this. And I can still picture my surroundings then, because it was a bit of a aha moment for me, because I'd felt a bit frustrated, I suppose. You know, I'd done the classic, you know, read Tim Ferriss's book, decided I really wanted to do this. I was mentally in, but I didn't feel yet like I had a clear path of how I was going to go about trying to make this happen. And this was a turnaround moment for me. And so I suppose there has been that 0 to 1 of Ben's model has been fantastic. And then there's also been other people along the way that I became, I guess, addicted to this, acquiring knowledge and implementing it. And so I suppose going back to the original question of what really worked from a kind of customer acquisition perspective, it was being really strict. Well, the first things first is this is a demand capture business principally, right? So that I think is slightly easier to learn than sometimes demand generation. I think demand generation and convincing people who are maybe not even problem aware yet, definitely not solution aware, to be aware of the problem that your product solves and then aware that your product is the solution to the product they weren't aware they had. I think that requires a sophistication and a level of marketing and then probably also a level of spend to be able to test and learn that sometimes demand capture doesn't quite in the same way. Whereas with demand capture, I was able to build a model, I suppose, where we leaned very heavily into organic SEO-driven traffic at the top of the funnel and we were very focused on making sure that we were brilliant when it came to topical authority and informational keywords around our product types. So if someone was trying to understand, do I need planning permission for my pergola? You know, what happens if I've got really strong winds in my area? What sort of foundations do I need to install it? What sort of fuel type is okay for this fire pit? Is it going to be warm enough for the area? How long is it going to last? All these things that happen when a customer is aware they might be interested because they've been to a friend's house or they've seen one somewhere, but is on that sort of long-term browsing journey, as happens with a lot of high-ticket products. You know, buying cycles can be measured in months rather than days. But we would be ever present there, helping them and kind of establishing ourselves as topical experts and trying to get as many touch points with the customer and bring them into our own funnel, whether that's getting them on our email list or, you know, getting them on site so we can retarget to them, whatever it might be. Coupled with that, being really competitive at the bottom of the funnel when it comes to paid advertising. And so we, over time with the business, essentially banded keywords as much as possible into what we felt their commercial value was to the business based on the intent they showed. And we would aim to be incredibly competitive on what we saw as really high purchase intent, low funnel keywords. Imagine we're selling a certain fire pit, a really low of the low in the funnel, high intent keyword might be something like, you know, 2 meter concrete rectangular wood fire pit, for example. That is a customer who knows what size they want, what finish they want, what fuel source they want to put in it, all these things. Like, this is a customer who's primed to buy if we can show them the right product, the right experience.
Man, those order change emails suck. They're always like, I ordered the wrong size. I meant to change the shipping address. Oops, I was drunk. Instead of making customers email you that stuff, let them fix it themselves with Cleverific. Cleverific is a self-service portal that lets customers edit their orders without bugging you. That means you get fewer headaches, customers get faster fulfillment, and there's fewer returns overall. Everybody wins. Peter Manning, New York, cut their support tickets by 99% with Cleverific. You want in on that? Get 50% off the pro plan, just $49 a month, exclusively for listeners of the Unofficial Shopify podcast. Go to cleverific.com/unofficial and use promo code KURT50. Done. Problem solved. That's Cleverific. You're going after these high intent, long tail keyword phrases. And then are these Google ads matched to landing pages or like SEO landing pages, just trying to get that traffic to the store?
Predominantly Google ads based on those keywords with specific landing pages. Yeah. So we were very competitive SEO wise at the top of the funnel. More difficult for us as a newer domain to be competitive at these sort of very highly transactional keywords. We kind of began to get there towards the end, but predominantly we were hyper competitive on paid search for these high intent transactional keywords, and then highly competitive up the top of the funnel with more organic searches, because it's obviously incredibly difficult, especially when you have dropshipping margins, which are traditionally lower, to have a profitable ROAS on a top of funnel lower intent keyword. So working that organically was far more effective for our profitability. And then the bottom of the funnel keywords were the ones that we really identified had a high propensity to convert. And then we could be more competitive with the CPCs required to get that traffic, even with our dropshipping margins, because we knew we had the properly tailored landing page, the kind of right keywords in the ad campaigns to be able to make sure they converted the right rate.
That's very clever. So top of funnel, we're going organic because it's broader. It's not going to be nearly as profitable. And then bottom of funnel, we're doing these really high intent keywords. But you know, by slicing it thinner, I would imagine you're getting better ROAS, potentially paying less than if you know using the broader terms at the top.
Indeed. And you can imagine, obviously, Google's a weighted auction, quality score and bid. And you can imagine if we're going hyper-focused on individual keywords and we're creating landing pages that are hyper-focused on those keywords, Google's perspective of what our quality score will be, and then also our user signals when customers get on those pages, help our quality score to be really high, which means that our bid doesn't need to be quite as high because our blended auction score of the two is higher because that quality score is so much better versus one of our competitors who is maybe taking a more generic approach to keywords and therefore their landing pages are less tailored, and therefore when a customer gets on those landing pages, the user signals they send back to Google are poorer. They might be bidding as much or more as us, but have a weaker quality score, and therefore we still outperform them in the paid search auction, despite the fact that actually we might be bidding less.
And then on the site itself, I would imagine it has to look trustworthy. If you're this focused on SEO, I bet you got a ton of content. It starts to become more like an educational resource. It's a little more brochure-like. Attempting to be a digital showroom experience, for lack of a better word, but like a really nice catalog, something that's not thin. That seems to be, when we think of dropshipping stores, it's like these thin, spammy stores versus, paint the picture. What did this site's content look like?
Yeah, sure. No, I think that's a good point. And yeah, that is a, We could never quite decide what we wanted to call it. But yeah, digital showroom, hybrid e-commerce, something like that. I think lead has sort of gone out of e-commerce a little bit as a term, unless it's for an e-commerce site that is trying to generate leads for a service-based business. But I think in high-ticket e-commerce, the value of a lead is still really high. So one thing we did is we started to view a success metric when a customer came to site as generating a lead and a deeper relationship with the business rather than a conversion. And that's because of the fact that there are longer buying cycles with these larger items, with more to consider, more that you're spending, etc. And so the first win was if we could get a customer onto our site, whether it's by organic or paid, and we could get them to appreciate that our site had enough knowledge, ability to consult with them, ability to add value, that they would become a lead. And that might be that they sign up for a certain sort of added value service that we try and help them with browsing. That might be resources that we've created, you know, how to work out if your area is suitable for a fire pit, or if you're going to need planning permission for this pergola, or if, you know, or what, how to measure up the space to decide what dimensions you're going to have, all these things. And, you know, this is true across saunas, standing desks, awnings for the side of my motorhome, you know, and 100 different high ticket products. You know, we had to find, through speaking to customers, learning about customers, what were the things that were at the front of their mind that they were struggling with, that other e-commerce experiences weren't giving to them, and show that we had done the thought, help customers with this, and sort of done a lot of the legwork for them, and that therefore we could add value. And if we were able to get them to become a lead by showing them that, and we did things as much, you know, even things to do with like CAD design and 3D render. We had a couple of people in Indonesia who are incredibly skilled at literally taking a photo of someone's backyard and superimposing a fire pit and a gazebo and other products like that into that space. And we were, you know, we were getting these done at points, like 3 to 5 of these done a day. But, you know, when there's gross profitability of maybe £1,000 or £2,000, you only have to kind of work out what a reasonable conversion rate might be off the back of giving an artifact like this to a customer. And obviously you have to work out who are the serious leads that you do this for, and you sink the cost, and who are the less. But yeah, we really started to work on get the traffic, turn the traffic into a lead, and establish ourselves as the best place to help them on this journey. And then after that, we felt that we could just genuinely try and help the customer from a point in the industry as well, where we covered most of the brands. So if they were working with the D2C store, they were getting information that that brand was the best, whereas we could give an impartial view. And we very much had a policy that if we felt that a customer was better off buying a £3,000 unit than a £5,000 unit, we would tell that, and we tried to engender trust and win word of mouth marketing, and accept that rate of conversions by actually serving the customer would serve us more in the long term than trying to constantly upsell inorganically. So all these things together, trying to replicate what people are used to in a physical setting from high ticket experiences in e-commerce.
Absolutely. I love the idea of you setting a specific policy in which it is okay to downsell someone on a product. If you're like, look, that's just the better solution, you don't need the more expensive one, because it ends up working out better for everybody. Like, yeah, you could have sold them the more expensive one, but would that have been the right item? Would they have been happy? Would you have gotten the word of mouth? Like, what's the real cost of doing that? You know, what's tremendous about this business is how quickly and how successful it was, and, you know, how rare and unusual that is. How did you interpret that success at the time? Were you like, hey, did it feel like, well, I'm putting in the effort, this is just how it goes, I'm a business genius? Or was it more like, the rocket ship has been ignited, I am now just holding on?
I would say first things first, I'm not very good at success. That's something I learned as part of this. It sounds a very negative thing to say. I actually think probably most of us aren't very good at success. I think most of us are kind of taught to be quite good at accepting our lot in life. And I actually think to like want more and be satisfied when you get it is probably actually a skill that you have to learn. So I guess first things first is a caveat would be that I was a huge part of the problem that emerged when the business started to scale. I do think there is a natural, like, for want of a better term, like a sometimes rapid growth can be a little bit of the hug of death. And that can happen to some extent, right? It's great to grow quickly, but sometimes really fast growth can remove the benefit of learning and having time to implement those learnings before the next stage of growth comes. And you can get out of your depth quite quickly with fast growth. And this being my first venture, and then me also being quite a financially anxious person, quite a cautious person, meant that rapid growth, I think I was a good personality to generate the rapid growth, because I was a bit of a grinder, and I was happy when I knew what strategies I needed to learn, understand, and put into place, and I did that well. The problem was then I was probably overly limited and overly cautious when it came to reinvesting and making sure the operational side of the business could keep up with the growth. And so, yeah, we did get to a point relatively quickly where I had probably grown the business beyond the point where it could operationally cope with what was going on. And then I was also at a point where I was probably in so much burnout from working 100-hour weeks, from keeping my corporate job, through all that growth and trying to do this along the side, that I then needed to try and unpick some of this, but I was in a state of such severe burnout that I became probably the worst hirer and trainer of any manager ever. So it was a little bit of a perfect storm in that sense, I suppose.
So how at peak, how big was the team?
There was a point where just me and my wife, just me and my wife and a subcontracting phone answering service were operating this business at over £1 million in revenue, which I don't say with pride. I say with what on earth was I doing in my mind.
I think it's incredible. I mean, I get why that would also be a little terrifying, especially with how quickly it occurred, but it's cool. You should be proud of what you did.
It was definitely cool. And, you know, it is incredible. Like, it does show how, you know, with certain things and certain things amongst this business model, that, you know, can be done at incredible scale. I think it's just the opportunity cost of that was huge. I think I could have found 50 to 100,000 a year for a team. And probably from the headspace that would have freed me up, made that back on the bottom line very, very quickly. And I probably could have had a bigger business that was just as profitable. I probably could have been a lot happier. With the benefit of hindsight. That's the benefit of some of what I know now. It's also, most importantly, from a place where my mind is infinitely clearer than what it was then. Like, I almost couldn't think straight because I was so locked in and just trying to keep up with harvesting all of the growth and demand.
It's tough when you're like, that's where you're too close to it, where you need to take a break, but you can't. It's hard. I think that is the cost of the rapid growth, especially when this is your first attempt at this. You don't have the experience and the perspective that someone who has tried and failed a couple times might have had before seeing the success.
Yeah.
How long after starting did you realize you wanted to sell it?
Honestly, I think I loved the idea of taking exit probably from the moment I started. One of the reasons I was keen to start a business, I was really keen to avoid starting something that was more arbitrage than a business. So the fact that a proper high-ticket dropshipping business as opposed to a more traditional dropshipping business was an actual asset built on customer relationships and manufacturer relationships that actually could be sold as an asset. So I think the idea of an exit always was like quite tantalizing anyway, probably not in such a short time frame. I mean, we ended up being pretty much 2 years from start to exit. And yeah, exit was a bit too literal, I think. It was less of a, oh, we're at the peak, let's cash in here, and more I need to take the panic exit here a little bit because I can't see a way forward and through this. Because I'm too close to it and too burnt out at the moment. And I can't see how I can get the space without harming the business by taking it because I've embedded myself too deeply in what needs to happen on a day-to-day basis.
So when did you sell?
Me and my wife got married. We just did a very simple spa day the next day to just try and, you know, decompress and enjoy the fact that we'd done that. And I had a 90-minute massage that my wife had booked for me, which with where my mindset and headspace was at the time was like a real scary place to be. 90 minutes silence with my own thoughts was the opposite of a spa treatment for me. And so I was having this massage and my mind just raced the entire time. I was so, so nervous. And I felt such an intense responsibility to my wife to be present, a good version of myself, you know, not super stressed, not either checking my emails and being on the phone, or at the very least thinking about wanting to check my emails and being on the phone. I thought, this is actually a bit of a wake-up call that this isn't really sustainable. You have gotten past a little bit the point of no return, and you are trying to hire people and do things and put processes in place to extract yourself out of the business, and you are continually doing a poor job at it because you are just so burnt out and cooked. You know what? Let's take the exit. It's still a fantastic exit, and it's still going to give breathing room to learn, to think, and then to go again in business, whatever that might look like, from a position of a much better mental state. And so that was, in a nutshell, the conversation I had with myself in that massage. And I came out of it, and I got back into the spa area with my wife, and I said, I want to list the business for sale. And I messaged a friend of mine who had exited a similar business about 6 months earlier and said, please send me the details of the broker you used, and I reached out to him that night.
Really, in the same weekend, you married your wife and divorced your business?
Yeah, but two brilliant decisions, actually.
You used a business broker. Good experience?
Medium experience would be my gut feel.
What's tough about it? Like, if you did it over again, what would you change?
I wanted to keep a lot of control over the process. And so the broker kind of created the listing, got all of the, worked with me to get everything in terms of information ready, to value it, et cetera, got it up on, the marketplaces like Flipper, et cetera. And then pretty much from the moment we had a letter of intent, all of the sort of 3 to 4 months of due diligence after that point, the broker was next to involved in. I think part of that, I think he probably should have done a bit more to insert himself into things. And then I think I should have also deferred to his expertise more. And I think what happened there is you can imagine like the emotion that exists as a first time person exiting a business. And then also the fear of if this all falls through, like I'm running on fumes here and I need to keep this business going and performing as well as possible because it's going to affect my multiple and affect how much appetite the buyer has. But also if this falls through and we have to start again with 3 to 4 months new due diligence, that's going to have a really meaningful impact on my life. So as you can imagine, I probably wasn't in quite the position of strength that you would like to be. And I think that's where the broker, who has the benefit of being without emotion and with the experience of having done this process, probably could have balanced me better. But also I do recognize that I'm a bit of a control freak and I probably cut him out of the process more than I should have as well.
I will say, Woodlark, still up. Appears to still be up and on Shopify.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, they haven't by any means run it into the ground. In fact, I've really enjoyed working with them. Small, kind of private fund. They only own 5 e-commerce businesses. I won't go into it because it's quite a long story, but incredibly cool story whereby the guy was ex-Air Force. He got commercial rights to equipment to go into face masks. Started selling them before COVID. As you can imagine, face masks was a pretty good business to be in when a pandemic launched. His team scaled insanely to cope with the demand. Pretty much the Foreign Office of every government was helping them to ship masks into the country. They were making money hand over fist. Jeff Bezos helped them get, I think it was £7 million or something out of their Amazon account to help them to continue to do what they needed to do. Anyway, then you can imagine COVID, in inverted commas, ends, things go back to normal demand, and they've got this huge team of manufacturing, customer service, advertising, etc., that are now essentially all redundant. So they took a huge amount of private investment money in order to buy businesses and plug them into this existing system in order to try and grow and scale them, which I think actually, this was completely by accident. I reversed into this. I would have sold to anyone who was willing to give me what I thought the business was worth at the time because I was that fried. But luckily for me, I think it ended up with a really good home because they were operationally excellent. I was operationally disastrous. The business was demand and acquisition excellent and operationally disastrous. So it was a bit of a match made in heaven. And I did a 6-month earnout with them or kind of consultation period because I'd created a huge amount of owner's risk, as you can imagine. If I disappeared off in my new car or whatever, then it would have been a bit of a disaster for them because a lot of the knowledge was in my head. So we worked together for 6 months on that, sort of gradually moving the time down. And I really enjoyed working with them. And I'm still kind of in contact. And I think they'll do really well with the business.
This episode is brought to you in part by Zipify One-Click Upsell. Hey, you still guessing which products to upsell? Yeah, look, that's how upsells worked like 5 years ago. But this year, in 2025, that kind of guesswork, it's just losing you revenue. One-Click Upsell by Zipify uses AI to recommend the best upsells and cross-sells based on your actual sales data, live, in real time. Yeah, it's smart, automatic, and way more effective than the old school "I hope this works" method. So just install the app, launch your first upsell funnel with one click. No code, no testing, and no more generic offers. You can upsell across the entire customer journey, the whole funnel, product pages, cart, checkout, post-purchase, thank you pages, even the shop app. And now they're tossing in a free cart drawer just for installing. Cart drawer is the best. Over 50,000 Shopify merchants trust one-click upsell, and it's already driven nearly $1 billion in extra revenue. So go to zipify.com/Kurt to start your 30-day free trial. That's zipify.com/KURT. I mean, fabulous to see that it's still going and that, you know, the earnout worked out. If you're going to sell a business with an earnout, that, you know, tends to be where the wheels fall off, as you don't get all of the earnout. That's where the dispute comes in. So if we got it all, you know, to work out to the end and it's still going, that's fantastic. I mean, this, that means it all worked. Did you mention how much you got for it?
Just above sort of £500,000, which obviously is maybe about $600K in dollars.
How'd you feel about it? Too good?
This is so hard to say because I actually think it was the right amount. I think I left a huge amount of money on the table, 100%. But if they would give it to me back now and let me come in with this fresh headspace and take it to whatever, £1 million in enterprise value or beyond, I think I could do that very, very well and pretty quickly. Had I have not burnt myself out in quite the same way and created this problem for myself, I think, you know, ultimately there are very few business ventures where I think I probably could have doubled the enterprise value in maybe a couple of years, not to mention the net profit that you can imagine. You know, you normally get about a 4x multiple on these sorts of businesses. So you can imagine, you know, 2 years of that net profitability plus the enterprise value, that's a pretty good return on 2 years worth of work, especially for a guy who was working a corporate job, you know, a few years ago. So in that regard, I left a huge amount of money on the table. On the flip side, I think I learned a huge amount. I also think it was a pretty much a non-negotiable for what I owed my new wife, my friends, my family, myself, my own mental health at the time. I think to continue in that way for two more years would have been totally irresponsible. Wouldn't have been good for anyone, probably nor the business. So in principle, like if you think of it purely financially, yeah, I left a huge amount of money on the table. In the long term, I think it will make me much more successful from the lessons I learned from it and having the ability to retrospectively go into new business ventures with what I've learned. Not to mention, like, just from a lifestyle perspective, it was so important.
Well, and at the same time, you know, it's easy to, someone who's not been in the position, it's easy to sneeze at it, go, well, that wasn't enough. But at the same time, you got $670,000 US cash and no, the equivalent of, that's a hard amount of money for anyone to turn down.
I can promise you that is more money than I've had in my bank account by a ridiculous multiple. So yes, it was life-changing enough. Of course, it was a stepping stone in what I certainly view it this way, as a stepping stone in my career. And with the exception of some of the harder bits, I really enjoyed the journey and I want to continue being in business. And I think I'll look back at this and be like, that was fantastic because it allowed me the space and breathing room to do some of these things. It allowed me the capital to do some of the things that I'll do next. And ultimately, yeah, great. It could have been $1 million or it could have been, you know, seven figures or whatever on the exit. But actually, I think there will be future, whether they're exits or, you know, whatever it might be, that happen because of what I learned from this business. So yeah, no, I can honestly say I have no regrets from the exit. I of course have, in a way, regrets of making myself need the exit, but again, I knew no better. You know, at least I've learned the lesson now.
But you know, that the value was in the experience, and then you get this tremendous payout on top of it. I would not be apologetic or upset about it in any way. I mean, it's thrilling. It's great. What did you do afterward?
When I exited, my wife thought, well, we should take some time off. I think we just had, you know, a huge injection of cash and you're completely burnt out. Let's take some time off. And I thought, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. I didn't love the idea of doing it. I was pretty excited. In fact, this is crazy, but on the flight back, I flew sign the papers with the buyer. We were in different areas because my wife and I moved to Barcelona in the final year of the business. So I flew there and I actually have notes in my notebook. I bought a new notebook at the airport and started writing out what I wanted my new venture to look like on the flight back, which I think that was a bit much. I wouldn't say that with like a badge of honor. That probably spoke to the fact that I was a little bit hyper productive at that time. But the main reason I did that was because in the lead up to the sale, I'd started speaking on podcasts. For example, like Ben Knegendorf has a community of people who sort of do this business, and then other sort of similar business owner, small business owner podcast of people who are in the first maybe like 0 to 3 to 5 years of their journey. And I started speaking, I suppose, quite candidly. I think I was just at a point where there was no energy left for facade. So, you know, you kind of come on these podcasts, and especially in the earlier phase of business ownership, you get put on a pedestal. It's like, you know, this guy has done what we all want to do. He's gone from corporate job to the, you know, to where this business is at. And I would talk about how great that had been because I was super grateful for it. But I would also talk about how mentally difficult the journey had been, how business had, I guess, shown me things about my own, like, limiting beliefs, my own anxiety, stresses, etc., that hadn't been highlighted before. And by the way, I think would have come up anyway outside of business. It would have just taken a different life stress to cause those. So again, I'm kind of grateful I had the opportunity to work through them, because better in business than arguably with the presence of your first child, or, you know, with some sort of like family illness or whatever might cause that life stress. But I essentially spoke about both the good and the bad, and was really overwhelmed by the outpouring of people who would reach out to me after that and sort of say how glad they were. Because I think we all have this feeling that we sometimes have to put a facade of success up in business, and therefore sometimes people feel, and I certainly feel this way, I had many times where I thought, this is such a shame, because clearly I have what it takes to build a successful business, but I don't have the requisite like resilience or, you know, emotional sort of strength and makeup to be able to hack it. I thought that's such a shame. And then over time I sort of started to be more open with my own experience, and therefore speak to people who are going through similar things, and I kind of learned that actually we're all just on this journey, and actually the whole challenge, to be honest, is kind of dealing with our own mental warfare and that sort of thing. So that was really, really powerful. And so I basically decided I wanted to just start working with these people in some way, whether that was just chatting to them, sharing experiences. Like, I'd learned that people seemed to get a positive reaction when I just talked about these things. So I wanted to do more of it, but I just didn't really know what it looked like. So I thought, you know what? I'll just use the fact that I've had the exit to talk about it openly, because I've got this moment where people will probably listen, because it's kind of like a nice story. And I will just chat to people who want to. And so I just offered, I just had coffees and, you know, virtual coffees, chats with people who are in the same sort of position. And sometimes we talked about business, sometimes we talked about the mindset side of business. And yeah, I found I loved it. I found when I was running the e-commerce business, a lot of the conversations I was having zapped me of energy. And then when I started speaking to, when I kind of felt like I'd, it's a bit of a corny phrase, but like found my people in terms of small business owners who wanted to, you know, wanted to do this to spend more time with their families, or to, you know, be able to spend more time with their partner, do things they want to do, you know, change their life in that sort of way. And they were having some success, but also some struggles, and we could relate to one another. And then also seeing that actually help them. Suddenly I was like, okay, this is what it feels like to do work where your energy doesn't get depleted. You actually get excited off the back of things. And I had so many times where, because I was speaking to also people in the US and Australia as well, so the time zones would often not line up, and I'd think, oh, I'm really tired and I've got a call with that person in Australia, and it's, you know, whatever, 10 p.m. here. And within 5 minutes of the call, I was so energized and I was wide awake. I was like, okay, this is really interesting. This is what it feels like to be, to get energy from a business venture rather than have it suck energy out of you. So yeah, that is, I suppose, in a nutshell, what I did next and why I went into it quite so quickly. And since then, I really have tried not to overthink what the business model is. I probably couldn't even really tell you what the business model is now. We have a membership that people can be a part of, but we also have a free part of the community. It's overall, it's called Founders Clubhouse. And
I was
going
to say, what's the name of it? Sounds cool.
It's called Founders Clubhouse, and it is essentially a space for predominantly new entrepreneurs, but indeed, that, you know, any that sort of feel like they are still fighting, which I imagine probably most entrepreneurs do, but sort of fighting their way through and struggle to have people in their life that sort of get some of those struggles. I think it'd be really hard to talk to friends, to family, to your traditional support circle about these things. And so it's a space for those people to essentially, like I did, find their people and interact and help each other overcome some limiting beliefs, overcome some of the sort of like mental struggles of entrepreneurship. And then also like a thought leadership knowledge sharing space. So I have spent time, whilst it's all still fresh in my mind, documenting a number of the different strategies that helped me to grow this previous business so quickly, from sort of paid advertising, SEO, and a number of things around conversion rate optimization in a lot of different facets. And then I've also lent on some people who helped me along the way as well, who are real experts in other disciplines to create some. And so that sort of library is available. And then we have a weekly coaching call where we jump on and we talk about something. If there's an expert from outside, they'll come in and sort of join it. But we also just use that as a vehicle for us all to chat and speak. We celebrate each other's wins, help each other when we're struggling. And yeah, it's been amazing. Some of it I work really closely, some of it's more like touch, but I love it.
You know, it sounds like you built the thing you wish you had.
Indeed. Yeah. I that's exactly it.
Yeah. And that's really cool. You're like, look, this was my experience and this is, I wish I had these tools. So I built them for you. And
yeah.
You know, now that feedback of like, I am helping people who I can empathize with their struggle. Wow. You know, now you've built this business that's much more satisfying. That's much more people oriented. Are you burned out now? You know what? Give me the difference in mental state.
Yeah, I honestly, I don't feel burnt out at all now. I think, firstly, I've been able to create some balance. I mean, the exit is fantastic for that because, so I have minority stake in a couple of e-commerce businesses where I sort of sit more in a, I think my sphere of expertise or where I'm strongest is probably in what we talked about earlier, sort of that acquisition side of things and how we sort of build the right system for generating awareness, demand, and getting people into the funnel. So I have minority ownership in a couple of businesses where I sit with a very prescriptive role. So it's like quite a clean headspace and I'm working on that, which is great. And then the rest of the time I spend doing this, where, like I said, I get energy back from the conversations. And I had it recently with one of the people who joined the community in its first like days. He had some really high stress around the back end of last year. And he sort of reached out to me and said, I'm so sorry to do this, but I'm feeling he was in an inventory business, e-commerce business, and he was really struggling to make his payments on the inventory financing that he'd had. And he was incredibly anxious and he had three young children. And he and I just sort of chatted through things, just tried to come up with plans. We jumped on a call maybe sort of twice a week perhaps. And it was both a privilege and horrible for me, because on the one hand, I could literally feel the stress and anxiety coming off him. And I've had that for different reasons, but I could really heavily, probably a little bit too heavily, empathize with where he was at. But on the flip side, he sort of came through that struggle. And, you know, I was delighted to even have been a small part of that. And then we started working together in sort of a weekly coaching capacity. And then he actually came out to Barcelona to see me about 3 weeks ago now. And we were talking about and planning for him. His business is now doing the numbers that allows him to sustainably kind of leave his job. He teaches at a different school to his kids. So he sort of has to be out early and he gets back quite late. So he barely gets to see his children. He's now going to leave his job, work from home. It's going to allow him to do the school run, to see his kids after work and that sort of thing. And he is so, so excited. And honestly, being a part of that journey is the most fulfilling thing I've done in work by an absolute mile. So, and there have been a number of others, none that are quite as emphatic as that. But yeah, that sort of thing goes a long way away from what keeps me a long way away from burnout, I suppose, because that was, if that happened once a decade, I think it would be enough to keep me working with satisfaction.
Well, I mean, clearly it's rewarding. Ma'am, my final question for you, where can we go and learn more about you?
So I've set up like a URL for the listeners of the podcast, which is just Founders Clubhouse, which is obviously FOUNDERS clubhouse.co.uk and then /Kurt. That whole website of Founders Clubhouse is a good place to learn more. But to be honest, I would love it if your listeners did want to learn more, that they kind of do that by just reaching out. So that will just take you to a very basic page that allows people to, first and foremost, give their email so that they get access to my diary. And I would love if anyone wanted to have a virtual coffee. To be clear, like, the agenda can be completely wide open. It can be about anything I've spoken about on the podcast or anything you might have heard about my journey. Obviously, I would love it if someone is maybe struggling a little bit, struggling with belief, struggling, you know, maybe they're in a similar situation. If I can be of any help to help someone through that, that's awesome. But also, I know as entrepreneurs, sometimes we get very excited about the tactical side of things as well. So if it is that you want to learn more about, you know, bottom of the funnel paid advertising or top of the funnel organic, whatever it might be, as I said, I've done a lot of work getting these things out of my head. So happy to chat about it. I always enjoy geeking out on these sorts of things. So whatever it is, I'm just delighted. Like I said, I made a pact to myself to just, now I've found my people in inverted commas, to just spend more time chatting to them and trying to give value. So if people go there and want to chat to me, I'll be very happy.
Jaden Clark, formerly Woodlark Garden, now Founders Clubhouse. Thank you so much for your candor. This has been really great.
Thank you so much for having me.
Crowdfunding campaigns are great. You can add social proof and urgency to your product pre-orders while reducing risk of failure. But with traditional crowdfunding platforms, you're paying high fees and giving away control, all while your campaign is lost in a sea of similar offers. It can be frustrating. That's why we built Crowdfunder, the Shopify app that turns your Shopify product pages into your own independent crowdfunding campaigns. We originally created Crowdfunder for our private clients, and it was so successful, we turned it into an app that anyone can use. Today, merchants using Crowdfunder have raised millions collectively. With Crowdfunder, you'll enjoy real-time tracking, full campaign control, and direct customer engagement. And it's part of the Built for Shopify program, so you know it's easy to use. So say goodbye to high fees and hello to successful store-based crowdfunding. Start your free trial and transform your Shopify store into a pre-order powerhouse today. Search Crowdfunder in the Shopify App Store to get started.